freedom of speech.
Our dangers and our opportunities.
This is our challenge, and this is our time.
It really is a revolution.
The science says it is more expensive to leave chronically homeless people homeless than it is to house them.
Homeless is defined as a state of having no home. It's been estimated that there are approximately 1 million people around the world who lack adequate housing. This includes those who live in their cars or friends' couches and various other makeshift shelters. So what's going on? Is this a crisis?
Episode 1, Part 1.
There's no question that homelessness is a crisis. Anytime people are unable to find a safe and legal place to exist, that's a human crisis. I am a professor of law at Seattle University School of Law, where I also direct the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Otherwise known as HRAP. I got into homelessness rights advocacy because while I was in private practice, I'm a lawyer, while I was in private practice in Chicago, I did a lot of pro bono or volunteer work on immigration. So I represented a lot of folks who were seeking asylum, political asylum, and noticed how for so many of them, there were not enough immigration attorneys. The representation of these defendants was just, there needed to be a lot more support for folks who were going through this extraordinarily traumatizing process, and how the overlap with housing instability and poverty was a big issue. And I looked around and noticed that as shallow as the bench was for immigration attorneys, there was no one who was there helping them on housing or homelessness or poverty. And so that got me focusing more and more on the relationship between race and immigration and poverty and homelessness. And that sort of led me on the path to really focus on homelessness because there are so few attorneys who really, really look at homelessness from, especially from a civil and constitutional rights angle, which is the angle that I look at it. We measure homelessness through a pretty weak method, but it's the only method we have. It's called the point in time count. The point in time count is where a bunch of volunteers go out, literally with, they get some training in how to look for people experiencing homelessness, and they walk around and they try to mark down folks that appear to be homeless. And then we get data from shelters and transitional housing on people who are already there. That data is pretty good. It's the data where you actually have just foot soldiers going out and trying to count folks. These tend to be massive underestimations, but it's the only data that we really have on the number of people experiencing homelessness in the United States. In King County, our most recent point in time count counted 12,112 men, women, and children experiencing homelessness. And about 52% of those, or the majority of those, are unsheltered, meaning that they're not in an emergency shelter or in transitional housing. They're living on the street or in their cars. When you're talking about that level, that's obviously a crisis. Some new numbers just came out on the number of homeless students we have. That's better data because schools actually, from the federal government, have to keep track the best they can of the number of students who are experiencing homelessness that come through the schools. And we know on a state level, we have well over 40,000 K through 12. These are just K through 12 numbers of children. And so when you look at all of those in the composite, we're really talking about tens of thousands of people who don't have a safe and legal place to sleep. The reason that's such a problem is once someone has no private place of seclusion, their existence in public space means that they are going to be pulled into the criminal justice system. And that's because of the way that we regulate public space. So this goes to criminalization. Criminalization is the way that our laws and policies prohibit or severely restrict one's ability to exist in public space. So the examples would be laws that prohibit or severely restrict your ability to sit, stand, sleep, accept food, ask for help, protect yourself from the elements, go to the bathroom. All of those sorts of things are things that none of us can forego, really, for even a couple of days and still survive. And yet people who are experiencing homelessness have no other alternative. They have no reasonable alternative other than to do those things in public, where this web of laws exists to catch them when they do it. And so when you exist in public space, it's a virtual guarantee that you are going to be pulled into the criminal justice system. There's a problem in criminalization, not just because it's there's some moral problems with it and some, you know, problems in the way that it sort of dehumanizes and punishes people. But there's also a problem because to the extent that we really care about homelessness as a crisis, we have to understand that criminalization actually makes it worse. So we are contributing to our own problem by pulling people experiencing homelessness through the criminal justice system for violations that are really just a consequence of them living in public. Most people experiencing homelessness are charged or arrested or ticketed for things like loitering or camping, you know, things that are literally just a consequence of being in a space that you're not supposed to be in, because we've told you you're not supposed to be there. And so when you look at what happens to someone who's ticketed or charged with those sorts of offenses, one of two things is going to happen. They're going to get a ticket, or they're going to get charged with a misdemeanor. If you get a ticket, that ticket is going to have conditions, and it's going to say something like, you have to pay a fine, or you have to show up to court for a hearing, or you have to stay away from a specific place for a protracted period of time. Any of those options are virtually impossible for people experiencing homelessness to meet, because they don't, whether it's because they suffer from mental illness and think that the CIA is actually giving them this ticket and now they're being monitored and so they're not going to show up to court. Transportation, lack of transportation, substance abuse addiction, domestic violence, no mailing address, no ID, no money, all of those sorts of things make it virtually impossible for most people experiencing homelessness to comply with that ticket. And then what ends up happening is that ticket grows and grows and grows and grows because they've failed to appear or failed to pay. And that means then they'll have an outstanding warrant for their arrest. And they do get arrested, right? And so now they've got the second choice, which if you don't get a ticket, you get hit with a misdemeanor. So once a ticket evolves into a misdemeanor, whether it's a ticket that evolves into a misdemeanor or you're given a misdemeanor originally, now you are rendered ineligible to receive services and treatment that is supposed to be available to you and be designed to help lift you out of homelessness. So by intervening in their public, you know, living the way that we do, by criminalizing the fact that they have no meaningful alternative but to live in public space, we have made that person more resistant to recovering from homelessness. So this is how we actually create and maintain our own problem. So I think if there was anything folks need to understand, it's that calling the police when you see someone who's homeless, who's really not committing a crime other than the fact that they have no safe or legal place to exist, starts that very costly rotating door that makes that person more likely to be back in that public space and less likely to ever escape from it. The best option would be for everybody to band together and advocate for enough housing. And this comes to something called Housing First. So the way that we traditionally approach homelessness, and I should be clear, we're really talking about a group of people that would fall within a subpopulation are considered chronically homeless. So these are folks who have been homeless for longer than a year or have had multiple periods of homelessness over the course of several years that amounts to about a year of homelessness. So they're your hardest to house. They're the people that you see living on the street. They are not the majority of our homeless population. They're about 28-29% of it. But they are the group that drives the polarized discussions about homelessness. I'm going to focus for a moment, if I can, on chronic homelessness, because I actually think in terms of solutions to homelessness, one of the key ways Seattle can make progress on this is to focus on chronic homelessness. And there's at least six reasons to focus on chronic homelessness. One is they're increasing, right? So we have a 28% increase in our chronically homeless population over last year. That is different than some other subcategories like families and children and veterans, which are going down. So our chronically homeless population is going up, 28% increase over last year, and it tends to increase over time. The second reason is that they are the most visible, as I just mentioned. So they really drive some of the most negative and divisive frustrations that constituents and officials and advocates and businesses have. So they have to be a part of our priority to focus on. They're also the most vulnerable. So if you think about that particular subpopulation compared to other subpopulations, this is the subpopulation that's living exposed on the street. Because they're living exposed on the street, they have higher rates of poor health. They all have a secondary condition like untreated mental illness, substance abuse issues, emotional or psychiatric challenges. So those secondary disabling conditions are a hallmark of what it means to be chronically homeless. And by the way, not all of them started that way, but once you're living on the street, you develop a lot of those conditions. Those conditions are both a cause and a consequence of homelessness. It's also important to focus on a fourth reason to focus on this particular subpopulation is that they are the most expensive in terms of public costs. So if you think about people experiencing chronic homelessness and you see an individual on the street, on average, that person left there, if we leave them homeless, is going to cost the city of Seattle anywhere from $50,000 to $80,000 a year to leave them where they are. And that's because people experiencing chronic homelessness are the highest frequency users of emergency services. They go in and out of hospitals, detox centers. The use of law enforcement is an enormous resource drain, going through the court system and then the jail system. All of those are insanely expensive ways to, quote unquote, treat homelessness. So as I mentioned, you leave someone who's chronically homeless on the street, on the average, they're going to cost us about $50,000 to $80,000. Now, if we were to invest in permanent supportive housing, that on the average costs $16,000 to $22,000 a year. So right away, it should be readily apparent that regardless of how you feel about compassion or whatever your motivations are, the science says it is more expensive to leave chronically homeless people homeless than it is to house them. And the final reason, it's actually not the final reason, but it's the last one I can think of, that we should focus on chronic homelessness is that we actually know how to solve it. And that's through Housing First and the use of permanent supportive housing. This is a challenge for people to wrap their minds around, because most of us start from a position of wanting to determine whether someone deserves housing or not before we give it to them. That is a problem because it actually doesn't matter whether that person deserves housing or not, because as long as they're homeless, it's still costing you more to leave them homeless than it does to house them. So I think we need to move beyond the sort of this calculation of how much does this person deserve help, and just realize that at the end of the day, the most cost-effective way to address the problem of that person's homelessness is to end it. And you end it by providing them with something called permanent supportive housing. Housing First is the model. And I can explain, essentially with Housing First, the idea is, did you ever see Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs? It was released in 1943. It's a triangle. So if you imagine your two hands, coming together with your thumbs joined, and you're looking at the triangle like a triangle, The Maslow's hierarchy of needs articulated a new understanding of human motivation, capability, and performance. Basically, across disciplines, explaining how and why people are capable of doing things and performing. And the notion of it is, at that very bottom level of the triangle, are basic physiological needs, like breathing, sleeping, eating, pooping, peeing, having a place to a safe and secure place to be. Those are all the basic physiological needs. And the idea is there's these different striations that go up the triangle. And at the pinnacle of the triangle is self-actualization. And self-actualization is basically where you can become your best self, right? The you can work on secondary issues like education, employment, family reunification, you know, really recognizing the best version of yourself. And there's different striations from the very bottom all the way up to the top. And what Maslow's hierarchy said was you have to address things from the bottom of the triangle all the way up to the top in that order, because otherwise people are literally not capable of dealing with these secondary issues at the top of the triangle if those fundamental basic physiological needs and all those other striations up the Maslow's hierarchy of needs are not being met. So it's a helpful model for people to think about when we talk about homelessness. And it's had an enormous impact on healthcare, business, marketing, and a little less so on homelessness and housing policy, which is too bad. The way that it has had an impact is through something called Housing First. So go back to the triangle. Basic physiological needs, right? Are at the bottom of the triangle. Self-actualization, dealing with secondary issues, is at the very top. Our traditional approach to homelessness is to start at the top of the triangle. And we show this all the time. Look at what the city does. They approach people experiencing homelessness and they say, hello, would you like services or treatment? And they all say, most of them say, yeah, no. You know what I'd like? I'd like a safe and legal place to be able to breathe, poop, pee, eat, sleep. But that's not what's being offered. There's emergency. I can give you, you know, a referral to emergency shelter, and I can explain why those are all smoke and mirrors. But at the end of the day, we're asking them to focus on the top of the triangle before the bottom of the triangle. Let's assume you say yes. I want services and treatment. So you go, you meet with a substance abuse counselor, and through some miracle you get there, and through some other miracle you get through all the paperwork, and you actually go through that session. Obviously, one session is not going to do it. And after that session, where are you going? You're going back to the trauma of living on the street. So it shouldn't surprise us that that intervention has very low probability of success. That person is going back to the tent where they're surrounded by all of the same pressures and vulnerabilities and violence that they started in at. The whole thing is just mind-numbingly stupid. The way that the traditional way we approach it is to expect people to engage in self-actualization before their basic physiological needs are being met. Housing First is a different philosophy, and it says you don't go up and ask people to fix themselves first and deserve housing. What you do is you give them housing, and the stability of that platform creates the leverage they need in order to eventually reach self-actualization. And this is not just, you know, sort of like kumbaya, this feels good. This is science. It's actually the most studied intervention in all of housing and homelessness policy, more than any other intervention. Years and years and years and years of studies, and they consistently show that when you provide someone with housing, and a permanent supportive housing means housing that has wraparound services available, but it's not a precondition of your housing. So you go to housing, and then on your own time, Once you have the stability and you are ready to make the choice to engage with services and treatment, those services and treatment are there for you. And what that shows is that by giving people that autonomy, which is so key to recovery and self-actualization, that people ultimately accept offers of services and treatment at higher levels. And when they once they have housing and once they undertake those services or treatment, the impact of that services and treatment are far more enduring than they would be without housing. So what you end up showing from the Housing First and Permanent Supportive Housing is a consistent, proven way of ending that person's homelessness, improving their social and health outcomes, better positioning them to achieve those other things that we want people to be able to achieve. And it's less expensive than doing nothing. What people can do is realize that the best response is actually not to think about responding to that individual right there, right then. It's about going to your city officials. It's about going to your policymakers and demanding that they stop flushing money down the fiscal toilet at the expense of everybody, and that they start investing in proven, evidence-based, data-driven solutions to homelessness. And for chronic homelessness, it is a resounding clarity, it is permanent supportive housing and Housing First. So that is, I know it's not satisfying because people want an immediate response to experiencing homelessness, but if there's the most powerful thing that your listeners can do is to actually become advocates, to demand that the city solve the underlying problem and stop wasting your money, stop putting people in extremely vulnerable and harmful circumstances. Most people, when they think about homelessness, the vast majority of which you actually don't see, you just see the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. But it doesn't represent most of our homeless population, but people think it does. And that's part of the reason why we need to address it so badly, is because it's what makes the public discourse and approach so fractured. It's a place that if we could make a difference, and I think we can, we know how to solve it. If we could make a difference there with the people who are the hardest to house, imagine what that would do for our feelings of optimism and hope that we could address. If you think about it from concentric circles, if we can address the epicenter, how much that success would mean for those, you know, concentric circles around the epicenter of homelessness. You have to be vulnerable, and a different way of saying it is you have to be open to learning something different than what you thought before. You know, the folks who are convening are folks who I think they're, the way that they're looking at homelessness has changed right now. A lot of folks just don't know how the way that we use the law creates and perpetuates and maintains homelessness. And when they do understand it, then they're usually incented to say, man, we should stop that. That's just stupid. And the same thing with respect to permanent supportive housing. I think changing people's minds so that they understand that it doesn't matter what your, you know, subjective calculation is of whether that person deserves housing or not is completely irrelevant. The problem is, leave homelessness as it is actually worse off for everybody. So now let's focus on what the actual solution is going to be and why that's the right choice. For a lot of people, they can't get past the deserving piece. That's part of what I'm hoping to provoke people to think about, is why does that matter? And what does not doing anything, what does the judgment that someone doesn't deserve it result in? It results in their continued homelessness, which you, my friend, are paying for. And not only that, by their continued homelessness, increases the likelihood, each day that's spent on the street increases the likelihood that person will never emerge from homelessness. So how does that help you? Proximity matters because when you bring two people together who are not typically together, it's an exercise in vulnerability. And if you're willing to, if you have two parties that are willing to have some shared vulnerability, that's absolutely necessary in order for there to be some sort of change. We have more shared problems than not, right? It's just a lot of it is differences in opinion about what the solution is. But even when that comes to pass, we sit there and fight about the solution so much, which solution should be used, that we are not even focused on the shared problem anymore. And that's where the problem ends up, you know, really never getting solved, right? Is at the end of the day. And that's because people who take those positions and say, this is the only solution and I won't listen to anything else, they're not becoming vulnerable, right? They're not in a vulnerable space, because you have to be willing to entertain the possibility that your solution might not be the only solution, or maybe your solution sprinkled with a little of their solution. And so it's vulnerable to put yourself out there. And the way traditionally you think about negotiation is, you know, you're supposed to have these positions, and if you give a little bit, then you're going to show weakness. The way it's baked into our brains is that if we show vulnerability, or if we take any risks, or if we really try to reach out, that risk isn't worth it, and that's the biggest, you know, misunderstanding that we have here. I'm having my own experience with proximity in a very different way. So because I'm a homeless rights advocate, I spend plenty of time with people who are experiencing homelessness or housing instability. What I don't do is spend a lot of time with business people. And we recently launched the Third Door Coalition. Pre-head tax life for housing and homelessness advocates was already really, really polarizing. It is one of the most polarizing, controversial topics that you can really strike up with someone, short of maybe, you know, race or sexism or something like that. So it's always been polarizing. But after the head tax, I think it was the common perception for folks who have been in this work for decades, felt more demoralized and more polarized than they ever had before. And it was looking really, really grim in terms of the outcomes, because that divide just got so deep that it didn't look like we'd be able to recover from it. So it was in that context that I got contacted by a number of conservative outlets who had heard me talking about the head tax and criticizing the head tax. And it's interesting, because though in those interviews, I made it clear that I actually supported the head tax, even being married to an Amazonian. I supported the head tax because I know we need more revenue in order to fight homelessness. However, I criticized the way that the city rolled it out. First, because it made it seem that the head tax was solely about businesses, and it was businesses' responsibility to fix the problem. The city would have been much better off rolling it out as part of a package that made it clear that every single one of us is going to need to put a little skin in the game if we're going to solve the problem. So part of it was framing and packaging. That was part of what I was criticizing. But I was also criticizing it because it's a very fair critique of the city's approach to the head tax. A very fair critique of that was to say, no one knows what you're spending the money on. And the reason that's a fair critique is because there were folks on the city council who were saying, we're going to spend the money on affordable housing and permanent supportive housing, and then these other things. And then the mayor's office was saying, no, we're going to spend the money on emergency services, and then some of it on these other things. So when you have contradictory messages from the folks who would be presumably deciding how that money gets spent, it shouldn't surprise the city that our constituents were not sure what the money was being spent for. So a lot of conservative outlets liked that someone like me was willing to look at what otherwise was really being touted as a very progressive, and should have been a very progressive approach to helping address homelessness. And it was in those conversations I went and presented to a number of different businesses. And before I went in, I thought, how am I going to use this opportunity to help bridge this divide that's become so bad? And so I thought a lot about areas of mutual interest. The area of mutual interest that has always fueled my work against businesses in the past has been the the position of businesses that homelessness is bad because it impacts their bottom line. And so businesses, you know, believe that visible poverty should be removed because it's an economic calculation. In the past, I felt like that was motivation for my work because it's morally abhorrent, right? that the reaction to human devastation would be, we can't see this. I don't care if it exists somewhere else. I just don't want it here. And so I started thinking about that and realized that maybe the answer was to say, okay, so they want to address visible poverty. They want it gone. You know what? So do I. And my motives are different. My reasons, you know, for doing this and focusing on this are different, but I sort of can't care why, because we have a shared problem. So if I can persuade them that the way to solve this is not to call the police and not to see this just as something where eviction or removal of visible poverty is the answer, then maybe we can make some progress. And so that's where the Third Door Coalition came in. As I made an invitation to a number of businesses, I made a proposal based on science and data and said, this is the way that we can solve chronic homelessness. It's been proven repeatedly. And if you want to join me in this, then we can both solve our shared problem. And that's what the Third Door Coalition is. And the reason it's called the Third Door is because we wanted to be very conscious of rejecting pushing ourselves or being pushed into one corner of the debate or the other, and recognizing that we don't have to share all the same perspectives. We don't have to vote for the same candidates. But when we come in this room together, we are partners. And we need to trust each other, and we need to, you know, have vulnerability with one another, and we need to be open to learning. Basically, what the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project does is it engages students. I used to say law students, but I actually work with students from different disciplines now. It engages students with experts from across the country and partners from across the country on solutions to homelessness. And so we sort of frame it as a two-handed challenge. So if you think about the right hand, for example, the right hand is the hand that people traditionally think of when they think about solutions to homelessness. So the right hand is the hand that is making investments in programs, you know, like emergency shelters or treatment, you know, affordable housing, that sort of thing. The left hand is the hand that most people don't even think about or know exists. And the left hand is the hand that enacts and enforces laws and policies that make homelessness better or worse. So because we traditionally don't understand that solutions to homelessness are a two-handed problem, what ends up happening is whatever progress the right hand is making, the left hand is undoing it. So the goal of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project is to really investigate both what the left and the right hand are doing, and to really make it much more visible the ways they need to work in concert with one another so that we can actually make some measurable progress. People who are experiencing homelessness are disproportionately members of other already marginalized groups. So people of color are disproportionately represented in homeless populations when compared to general populations. People who are LGBTQ, especially with respect to our homeless youth, somewhere around 40+% of our homeless youth population identify as LGBTQ. And the reason they became homeless has everything to do with the fact that they've been kicked out, or rejected or otherwise, you know, sort of expelled from the family because of identifying as LGBTQ. Immigrants. Single female-headed families. For single female-headed families, domestic violence is the number one cause of homelessness for single female-headed families. So when you really sit down and peel it open, it's not the majority of reasons people become homeless don't have anything to do with bad choices. It has to do with bad lottery It has to do with lack of affordable housing, untreated mental illness, which is not a choice, domestic violence, which is not a choice, sexual orientation and identity, which is not a choice, being a person of color, which is not a choice, being an immigrant, which is not a choice. So, I mean, you can, all of these different dynamics come into play that make it much more likely that those groups, members of those marginalized groups, are much more likely to become homeless. Another real big problem with respect to homeless youth and young adults is the foster care system. And we've recently put some reforms into place, but the way that the foster system has been working is that kids who are in the foster system, the rates of becoming homeless are astronomical because they age out. Or they run away from the foster care system. And so the foster care system itself is broken, and it becomes a major conduit for youth who are likely to experience homelessness. I think if folks can get a better sense of who's homeless and why, it will help them to see that the calculation of whether someone deserves not to be homeless, whether someone, a human being, a man, woman, or child, deserves a safe and legal place to exist, is first off the wrong question, right? So I hope that that will be part of what all of these sorts of conversations can do, is to get people to prompt them to learn more about who's homeless and why. To prompt them to think about and learn more about the way that laws and regulations make homelessness worse. In other words, the way that we are complicit in creating our own problem. And then turns people, I hope that it activates them, you know, turns them into advocates who say, this is unacceptable. And the response, the immediate response should not be to call the police. That's actually the most expensive and least effective response. Instead, how about call your city officials? How about call your lawmakers and demand that they end this person's homelessness? Because ultimately, that's the only thing that's going to stop that person from cycling through this sort of spiraling downward rotating door. People should not feel like all solutions have to be immediate, because they're not. But for people who are looking for something simpler to do, they can engage in more meaningful and sustained opportunities for proximity, meaning get closer to people experiencing homelessness. Most civil rights movements have been fueled by integration. Right. I mean, we saw that with respect to the race and civil rights movement, the race civil rights movement. We've seen it with respect to women's roles in the workplace. It has to do with integration, getting people around you who you're not used to being around. LGBTQ rights. I've actually written on this, how the role of proximity fuels social change. It's much harder to gain proximity with people who experience homelessness because, by definition, they're fringe walkers. And we don't have any really meaningful, sustained ways to break down those silos and to create those connections. The best way that we currently have is for people to volunteer. And fortunately, here in Seattle, we have a number of really awesome organizations that do an incredible job managing volunteers. And those are great ways to meet the men, women, and children who are suffering this extraordinary trauma. Places in particular that I like, Mary's Place does a great job managing their volunteers. Youth Care is another organization that I think provides really meaningful opportunities for people to engage. So that's something easier that people can do. But I hope it doesn't dissuade people from also really activating and becoming advocates for change.